From NPR News, this is live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. At 2 p.m. Eastern Time, what had already happened was still obscured in the dust and fire and smoke at the World Trade Center in New York, at the Pentagon in Northern Virginia, and in a field near Shanksville, Pennsylvania. NPR's Melissa Block reported from a downtown Manhattan utterly transformed.
Virtually every major building is being evacuated. People are trying to get home with no way of doing so. The subways are shut down. The tunnels are shut down. You see people clustered around cars with their doors open and the radios blasting the news of what's going on. People clustered with their hands over their mouths in horror, lined up at payphones trying to call their relatives and loved ones to let them know they're okay. Phone circuits are crazy. It's almost impossible to get calls through. And huge, huge clouds of smoke billowing over the entire city, visible virtually everywhere you go.
NPR's Steve Inskeep watched the terrible wound torn open when a hijacked airliner crashed into the Pentagon.
What we're looking at now is this enormous gap in the building that has been opened by the explosion. Periodically, you see another piece of wall come tumbling down. As fire crews continue working here, there are still flames shooting out of a few of the windows along the side of the building, and an enormous medical treatment center has been set up for the wounded outside. Medical helicopters have been coming and going, taking away some of the worst wounded, some of the burn victims, others apparently being treated here, and we have no information as to casualties.
All over the country, the sky was chillingly clear. By this time, almost every civilian aircraft was on the ground. Air Force One whisked President George W. Bush from Florida to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana.
Freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward. And freedom will be defended. I want to reassure the American people that the full resources of the federal government are working to assist local authorities to save lives and to help the victims of these attacks. Make no mistake, the United States will hunt down and punish those responsible for these cowardly acts.
We all witnessed history that day. In addition to the terrible scenes everyone saw on TV, we saw indelible moments of reaction and response. Call and tell us your story. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's begin with a caller. Joseph is calling from Travis Air Force Base in California. Joseph, are you there?
Hello?
You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hey, how are you? During the attacks on September 11th, although I wasn't in New York, I was in that Central Florida area, student at the University of Central Florida. I was on my way to a rehearsal in the morning for the jazz big band. And it was within just moments after the second plane hit the tower that the entire university was shut down. People were exiting en masse from the university and literally going into people's homes for as many as 18 hours, just watching TV, ordering out the pizza, and just flabbergasted by what they were seeing on television. And then also in the Central Florida area, there's a flight simulation building there, and we saw military-grade barricades put up there within a few minutes. So the response time, even though we were states away in a completely different region of the country, was remarkable. So it was wonderful to see how fast we can respond to that situation when it did rise.
And you're now calling us from Travis Air Force Base. You were a member of the military?
I'm a member of the United States Air Force Band of the Golden West out of Travis Air Force Base, and we performed today out at Capital Air Show in Sacramento. And it's always a pleasure for me to be able to serve and go out and let people see what our military is doing and to tell their story and to also be engaged with the public at a very tangible level, because it's not very often that they get to interface with military professionals, and they know that what we're doing is tough work, and the appreciation that they show us is always overwhelming.
Joseph, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care. Thanks a lot.
New York Times reporter C.J. Chivers was in Lower Manhattan on September the 11th. By coincidence, he joins us today from his home in Providence, Rhode Island. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And why were you in Lower Manhattan that day?
Well, it was the primary day. It was, you know, one of the election days in New York, and I had been assigned to go down at about 6 a.m. for the opening of polls to the Board of Elections building in case there were problems with polls around the city. There was a call-in center where those problems would be reported, and I was there. It's kind of as a just-in-case assignment, and had been there for a few hours when my pager went off and was told that a plane had struck one of the towers.
And you went down to the World Trade Center?
Well, it was a couple of blocks away, and I bolted down the staircase and thinking that perhaps there had been an accident. I didn't really consider it to be an attack yet, and was my thinking, because I covered the police as my primary beat at the time, was that the police and the fire department would set up their center for fighting the fire in the other tower. And my ambition was to get into that second tower before, if you will, the fences went up and they started blocking the public from getting near. So I was sprinting towards the second tower when the second plane came in.
The press passes on the badges carried by reporters in the city of New York say allowed to cross police and fire lines wherever formed. Of course, that's one of the great lies ever written anywhere because you're very often not allowed to pass police and fire lines. As you then went toward that second building, what did you see?
Well, there was this enormous flash sort of up above my left shoulder, almost vertically above, and I didn't know what it was. It was just so extraordinarily powerful, and the first reaction was really an animal reaction. I kind of broke in the opposite direction and dashed across traffic and dove onto a pile of people under some scaffolding because you could see overhead things spinning and falling through the sky. And, you know, the first reaction was to get out of the path of what was coming down.
And as you remember that day, it must, well, those memories are obviously vivid, but the rest must sort of be a blur.
It is a blur. And even those, in some ways, now, all these years later, seem they seem kind of foggy because so much has happened since, and I've traveled so much since, and a lot of it, you can draw a direct line back to what happened in those first few minutes. But while you're actually participating in them and you're out there in the field, you know, I cover Iraq, I cover Afghanistan. While you're out there, it's sometimes hard to make the connection that what you're doing actually is rooted in what happened on that day. And by that, I mean, you can, you know, in another week or so, I'll be out on patrols again with American soldiers. And sometimes when you talk with them, they're so invested in what they're doing in the moment and in the day. And they have an internal logic to their patrol, trying to stay alive and accomplish their job, that you sometimes ask them, can you draw a line from where you are and what you're doing today back to then? And many of them can't anymore. You know, we've come a long way in 10 years.
The line, as direct or indirect as it may be, is nevertheless vivid in your career. Anybody knows the being just in case assignment down at the Board of Elections is not the assignment for a senior correspondent at the New York Times.
Well, it was a big election, and at the time I was covering the police, and it was one of those things I could do in the morning and be ready for the regular shift, you know, perhaps at midday to get back to covering the police. So it had its logic, but you're right, it's a lot different than what I do day to day now.
12 days you were down at Ground Zero.
Yeah, I stayed. I did get in past the line before the fences got built, if you will. And I realized if I crossed out of those fences that I might not get back in. So I stayed through the first night and cell phones weren't working. So I would find landlines and the like in various buildings and call in reports to the paper. I came out and changed clothes at one point and went back in for about 6 more days and worked as a laborer. By then, the cell phones were working again, and I could call in reports as I worked. And then, as the security got tighter and tighter, I then went in with the National Guard for 6 more days and accompanied them as they were doing some of the security and the cleanup down there. But 12 days, but it's in some way seemed like one giant day because I barely remember sleeping.
And is there any memory that sticks out, any conversation, any story that you remember especially well?
Well, I think the thing that's most vivid is that first instant. But I do come back a lot when I think about it to when the first tower fell, because that was every bit as much of a surprise. I mean, looking back on it, we probably should have expected that, but it seemed impossible at the time. It seemed like there were just two big fires that were being fought. Of course, something much more elemental was in play. And I remember when the tower fell, I was looking out the doorway of a building nearby. I was in line to use a payphone, and I was sort of situated perpendicular to it, so you couldn't see the building as it came down. But the earth just started to shake and vibrate, and you knew exactly what it was. You knew, oh my God, one of them's coming down. And there was a priest next to me, and I watched him muttering, and I could see the fear in his face. And I remember being very afraid myself, all of those things coming together at once. And then it was a glass door I was looking out, and it was like you were underneath a pond. The blast wave came by with all of the debris and smoke and dust, and it just stuck against this glass window and made it completely opaque. And there was a bag of potato chips or something that stuck against the window very briefly and then flashed away, carried off by the blast. And sometimes I find myself just seeing that bag of potato chips or that wrapper right there. And it's just a testament to, you know, how ferocious the catastrophe was, you know, right outside the other side of that door.
C.J. Chivers, thanks very much for your time and for your memories. Good luck on that next assignment.
Thank you for having me.
New York Times reporter C.J. Chivers covers the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. He joined us from his home in Providence, Rhode Island. We were all witnesses to history 10 years ago today. In a moment, we'll talk with NPR's Tom Gelton, who was inside the Pentagon when the plane hit there, and with Don Gonge, who was just arriving at the White House. Tell us, what did you see that day? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks from NPR News. This is live special coverage from NPR News of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. I'm Neil Conan. The images and sounds that played out on television and radio that crisp September day 10 years ago still cling to our collective memory. History has bound us together, Nancy DeWolfe Smith wrote in a recent Wall Street Journal piece. Even as it made us unique, we are the sole witnesses to events that future generations will only watch and read about through the haze of time. There are many ways to mark this anniversary. Today we're doing it through your stories. 10 years ago, we were all witnesses to history, indelible moments of reaction and response. What did you see that day? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's go to Bill, and Bill's on the line with us from Salem in Oregon.
Hello, Mr. Conan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
10 years ago, I was a fire captain here at the city of Salem. And I was on duty that day, and during the normal course of our duties, one of the things we do is go to the supermarket just to do our shopping. And we were, of course, in our uniforms and had the black bands around our badges to honor the fallen New York firefighters. And members of the public there in the store would just come up to us and just touch us and just hold on to our arms. And a woman gave me a hug and just said, thank you for your service. And that was one of the most remarkable things that had ever happened in my 30-year career.
People would just come up to touch you.
Yes. I remember a man coming up and just grabbing a hold of my arm and just looking deep into my eyes and just saying, thank you for your service. And we normally, as firefighters, we don't like being noticed in such a fashion. We like to pass through unobtrusively as possible, and such attention is very unsettling.
Yet that day,
it was easily one of the most poignant moments in my life. I have not forgotten it, and it still draws deep emotion to me now.
I can hear it in your voice, Bill. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
In the hours and days after the attacks, Stanley Mises was a frequent guest during NPR's coverage. He lived only several blocks from the World Trade Center. He joins us now from his apartment in Jackson Heights. And nice to have you with us again. Good to talk with you again.
Thank you, Neil.
At the time, you lived, I guess, about a mile away from the World Trade Center. We heard a clip of a conversation we had 10 years ago at the beginning of the program. You described feeling the heat after you ran downstairs.
Well, actually, it was a lot closer than a mile, more like six blocks. One of the things that I recall running downstairs was after feeling the initial shock, I mean, my entire building just sort of bounced the way we felt it this week when the earthquake hit. And looking at that gaping hole with the flames pouring out, I could only imagine, as I stood there looking at it, that if this building toppled, we were all finished. If it fell forward, we were all crushed and finished. And it just, I just sat there mesmerized thinking about that until the moment it actually started to go down. And then, like everyone else, the panic just overtook me. And I ran back to my apartment just in time to reach the staircase, to come upstairs, close the windows, just as my street went black with the debris of the North Tower.
You were evacuated, like everybody else in downtown Manhattan, a little while after that. You went back. I remember you telling us you discovered the end of my street is now the beginning of Ground Zero.
It was. And every day thereafter, another something came out of the pile, either a crushed van or a bus or a car or a giant dumpster full of ash and debris. Something was on our corner every single day coming out of there, and it was kind of hard to take.
Why did you eventually decide to move?
Well, my landlord came to me during the time that my neighborhood went very quiet during this period. There was very quietly a lot of developers who moved into the neighborhood and started to fix things up. A few years later, they opened their buildings, and what had been a reasonably priced neighborhood suddenly became Millionaire Row. And my landlord came to me and said, you know, I'm going to double your rent, and I know you can't afford it. Out.
Have you been back down in the last several weeks to see how it's changed?
Not in the last several weeks, but a little while before that, yes.
And what's it like now?
Well, I'm glad to have moved. And ironically, I've moved to a neighborhood that is probably one of the busiest Muslim neighborhoods in all of the city. From my window, I can see the mosque and hear the muezzin calling to prayer. It's a fascinating neighborhood in the way that Manhattan has become not so fascinating, with ethnic life, with the striving of immigrants, with a kind of buzz on the street that you simply don't have when your price point starts at a million.
And looking 10 years back, that history that you saw happen, that awful moment as your life and your neighborhood were completely transformed forever.
In fact, that is true. I mean, there's almost nothing that's happening for me today that I can relate to back then. I mean, anyone who tells you that, you know, 50 is the new 40 didn't turn 50 in this decade. It's a very different life.
Stanley Mises, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure, Neil.
Stanley Mises is a writer based in New York. He joined us from his apartment in Jackson Heights in Queens. Let's see if we go next to this is Carol. Carol with us from Louisville.
Hello.
Hi, Carol.
I just have something very brief. I was a military surgeon at the time and was doing some volunteer service at the VA Medical Center in Louisville, Kentucky. And when the first plane hit, of course, many people subscribed it to an accident. And then the second hit, and I thought, oh, my God, they're killing us. And some of the gentlemen that were there, and it was mostly men, started shaking, and a couple started crying. And I thought, you know, at their age, this kind of upset that they were afraid. And I started trying to reassure them. And a couple of them turned to me and said, I'm not angry. I'm not afraid. I'm angry. I am really, really angry because all that I did, and they still won't stop. And that really brought it to home that this kind of attack and this kind of bad behavior has been going on since way before I was born. And at the rate things are going, it doesn't seem like it's ever going to stop.
Carol, are
me very sad.
Are you still at the hospital?
I no longer work at the Veterans Administration. I'm up in private practice now. I left the military a few years ago.
Well, thank you very much for what you did. We appreciate it. And thanks for the phone call.
Thanks.
This from Susie in Austin. My husband and I were in France. I was expecting my first child in 3 months. We had just spent the morning in Normandy reflecting on the horrors of World War II. Walking back to the tour bus, we heard people screaming and crying and radios blaring. My husband and I couldn't believe it. I had to spend the next 2 hours in a bus ride back to Paris thinking, how can I bring a child into a world like this? I will say, listening to the morning's remembrances and thinking about how far we've come, I feel some ease, some confidence in the goodness of mankind and the ability to identify an enemy and to overpower it in some way. Well, joining us here in Studio 3A is NPR's Tom Jelton, who was at the Pentagon when the American Airlines Flight 77 hit that building. Nice to have you with us, Tom.
Hi, Neil.
And I know you were down in our little bureau, our booth down in the bowels of the Pentagon, quite some ways away from where the building was hit. Did you feel the impact at all?
Not at all, Neil. And as you recall, having been there, because it is a radio booth, you know, it's built with a certain amount of cushioning and soundproofing in order to precisely to protect it from sounds in the area. So for that reason, and because it was on almost exactly the opposite side of the Pentagon, I didn't feel a thing. I didn't hear a thing.
And you were, of course, working on the Pentagon reaction to what was happening at the Department of Defense, what had already happened in New York.
Well, I had just moments before stopped at the offices of a military officer whom I knew well and who just happened to be in his office. And I said, what's going on? And he was the one who said, we have confirmed these planes that hit the World Trade Center were hijacked. This is a terrorist attack. So I got that from him, literally ran down the hall to our booth and immediately alerted NPR. I have the Pentagon's official confirmation that the United States has been hit by a terrorist attack. And I went on the news with that reaction, with that confirmation from the Pentagon, not thinking for a moment that the building in which I was sitting was itself about to be hit.
And when were you aware of that?
I became aware of that. This is sort of an embarrassing. It took Bob Edwards, who was the host of Morning Edition, coming to me on the air saying, Tom, we have word that the Pentagon has been hit. And I was, to tell you the truth, I was skeptical at first just because I had just been outside. I saw nothing out of the ordinary. And no sooner had I told Bob that it seemed to me that everything was fine, I could hear the public address system in the background ordering an evacuation of the building. And then I saw a SWAT team running up and down the corridors. I got up from my desk, just went outside to the hall to investigate, and I was immediately grabbed by a police officer. I didn't have a chance to go back and sit down and tell NPR what was going on. I didn't get a chance to pick up a tape recorder. I just was herded out of the building.
People unfamiliar with geography, the Pentagon is mostly accessible by subway. There's a big parking lot, but I assume you couldn't get home because you took the metro.
No, I didn't take the metro. In those days, this was before, there's now the highway that runs by the Pentagon has been shifted away from the Pentagon, as you know, mm-hmm. because it was considered, after 9/11, it was considered way too easy for a truck bomb to come in on that highway that ran right alongside the Pentagon. So that was moved away. But in those days, there was a press parking lot that was right by the Pentagon, and I was parked there, but my car was sealed off. I wasn't able to get to it for 2 days afterwards.
And what's your most vivid recollection of that day?
The most vivid recollection, because I couldn't get to my car and because the subway was not operating, I was asked by NPR to come back to the headquarters and file a report. I had to walk, and you know how far it is from the Pentagon to here to NPR headquarters. It's about 5 miles. And I had to walk. This would have been about 3 o'clock in the afternoon from the Pentagon back to NPR, walking over the 14th Street Bridge over the Potomac River. I look down. I see military boats patrolling the river. I get into the downtown. There are armored personnel carriers, Humvees, uniformed military on all the street corners. you know, I'd spent a lot of time in war zones. I'd spent time in Sarajevo. I knew what a city in a war zone looks like. I had never dreamed that I would see Washington, D.C. transformed into a war zone. That's the memory I have, walking through the city and seeing it basically transformed into a war zone.
NPR's Tom Jelton with us here in Studio 3A. Tom, thanks very much.
You bet.
This email from V.L. Brady. I was stationed at Fairchild Air Force Base in Spokane when the attacks occurred. We immediately went to ThreatCon Delta, and the base was locked down. We'd been practicing for something like this for 10 years, but it was still such a shock. I had a friend at the Pentagon and was terrified she had been killed. She wasn't. Nothing else was ever the same. Joining us here also in Studio 3A is Don Gagne, who was NPR's White House correspondent in 2001. And Don, nice to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
And that morning, I guess you were just making your way through security.
I was. I had taken the opportunity to take my kids to school that morning. And after I dropped them off, I got the phone call from an editor who said a plane has hit the World Trade Center. We're going to have to keep an eye on that. I mean, we had no clue at that point, obviously. While we were on the phone, the second plane hit. I hustled down to the White House. And as I was going through security at the Northwest Gate, someone on the other side of the gate yelled, "The Pentagon has been hit." And prior to that, the White House seemed relatively calm, you know, not quite normal. But at that point, all kinds of chaos ensued. And the uniformed Secret Service agents, you know, the guys who looked like local cops, suddenly they had, you know, some of them had automatic weapons. And the building was evacuated. And it was quite a terrifying thing to witness. Yeah.
The building of the White House evacuated.
The White House evacuated. And again, at that point, I think there was the sense that the White House was a target in and of itself. Perhaps the other missing plane, obviously.
And we didn't still to this day don't know if it was aimed at the White House or at the Capitol or where it might have been intended to go, probably one of those two places. But that's just a guess.
Exactly. And this would have been the same moment when, you know, we've heard the stories of Dick Cheney, the vice president, was in the White House at the time, was being carried by Secret Service agents down into the bunker. And we evacuated, and there was kind of an ever-widening perimeter that they kept creating over the next 10 or 15 minutes. But you would see the staffers pouring out of the White House and young women running, carrying their high heels so they could run up the driveway more quickly. There was one moment where I was kneeling in the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue because all of this chaos was kind of breaking out around me, and I'm realizing I need to get my gear out. I need to start recording some of this sound, and I look up, and there are all of these guys in white coats with chef's hats, and I'm thinking, is this some kind of a strange, you know, Monty Python dream or something? But that night, there was a congressional barbecue plan for the south lawn of the White House, and these were folks there working all day doing food prep. They came out the front as well. And I also recall the moment of kind of odd reassurance when you saw a fighter jet circling low over the city, something we hadn't seen before.
Surreal, but reassuring at the same time.
Exactly.
Thanks very much, Don.
A pleasure.
Don Gagne with us here in Studio 3A. And let's go to the other side of the attacks on that day, where a memorial was dedicated today. NPR's John Itzde joins us now from near Shanksville, Pennsylvania. John, good of you to be with us.
Nice to be with you, Neil.
And I should point out, you were sent there on assignment 10 years ago.
Yes, I was. In fact, I was sitting at my desk at NPR, just listening to Tom tell the story about the Pentagon, and I saw the smoke rising over the downtown area and thought it was maybe the Washington Monument had been attacked. Turned out to be the Pentagon, and very shortly later, we heard that there was another plane that had crashed in Pennsylvania that had also been hijacked, and I was immediately dispatched to go up and see what was going on here, here in near Shanksville. And it was a difficult getting out of Washington, as Tom was saying. You know, people were walking, filling the streets, the cars, people driving were in traffic jams, but finally got out and drove up here furiously. It took about 3 hours. It seemed like it would never end. And, you know, when I got here and got to the crash site, there was already cordoned off, but I was able to stand on a hill just above where I am sitting right now. And they said the plane crashed down there. I'm looking at it right now. And there was a trench in the ground, and it was smoldering. But there was no sign that jetliner had crashed there. There was no tail section, there was no wing, there was no fuselage. It was just a smoldering trench, certainly not big enough to contain an airliner. And it was baffling. As it turned out, what happened was that when the plane hit the ground at 580 miles an hour with 7,000 pounds of fuel, or 7,000 gallons of fuel, it exploded, vaporized the passengers largely and much of the airplane and shredded the rest of it. And there is a debris field just back behind where it crashed in this hemlock grove. And actually parts of the plane were raining out of that for months after whenever a wind would come up. They'd have to go in and clean it up again. But it was striking because there was almost no sign from where I could stand that a jet plane had gone down there.
NPR's John Itzty in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, as he was 10 years ago. A memorial there was dedicated with the names of the 40 passengers killed and crew on that day. This is special coverage from NPR News. From NPR News, this is live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. I'm Neil Conan. Today, President Obama is set to visit the three sites where terrorists turned hijacked planes into bombs 10 years ago. In Lower Manhattan, he touched the names of the victims etched in bronze at the new memorial and read a brief passage, Psalm 46. In a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, he helped place a wreath near the field where passengers wrestled control of United Flight 93 from the hijackers and gave their lives to make sure no one else lost theirs. Later today, he's scheduled to lay a wreath at the 9/11 memorial just outside the Pentagon. There are dozens of events scheduled this weekend to honor the victims and the heroes of September 11th. You can find several of those and reflections on today's anniversary at our website, npr.org. We all witnessed history that day, in addition to the terrible scenes everyone saw on TV, indelible moments of reaction and response. Call and tell us your story. 800-989-8255 is the phone number. The email address is talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Todd. And Todd's on the line from Corvallis in Oregon.
Yeah, hi, Neil. My experience was I was over in Copenhagen, Denmark. I was working with refugees and refugee children and was in a refugee center. One of the kids called me, and I went into this room where they're watching television and walked into the site of the first tower burning, and then suddenly thinking it was a movie, and then suddenly seeing the second plane hit the second tower, and one of the boys who was from Afghanistan started yelling, "Taliban, Taliban," and just that whole scenario, and then to see how it's played out later on was really surreal.
The boy from Afghanistan seemed to know more about it than you did.
Yeah, and no more than most of us, I guess. But for him, he was a refugee in Denmark because of the Taliban. And so for him, everything evil, I guess, was Taliban, and that was his response to what had happened. I thought that was very interesting. And then the other interesting thing was, of course, to see the outpouring of support that we received. The American Embassy was just... the front entranceway was completely blocked by flowers and candles and all-night vigils. And, you know, it was just really heartwarming to see all the support that we had from overseas. So that was just a perspective that, you know, what other people were seeing. And the silence on the streets of Copenhagen was just stunning. I mean, everybody was stunned. It didn't just hit New York. It hit everybody. And I think that was one of the most poignant things for me.
Todd, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Let's go next to Kim. And Kim's with us from Madison in Wisconsin.
Yes, hi. I was working as a receptionist for a company in Austin, Texas. And what I noticed was before I even knew anything that was going on, the phones were really quiet. And then I noticed also that all the brass were upstairs around the TV and no one was paying attention to any of their posts at all. The business went completely dead. no calls, nothing. And it was just really frightening. And one of the ways that I deal with this is I watch Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. And I also watch The End of America by Naomi Wolf.
And that's how you deal with it?
That is how I deal with the 9/11 catastrophe. I thought for sure America was being taken over.
And yet it was a horrible, horrible event. Four different planes hijacked, three separate attacks. Yet it was, that was it. That was it that day.
Yes, and being Jewish and having had relatives who have suffered the Holocaust, it was very sobering.
Kim, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Palestinian journalist Daoud Kutab was in Amman, Jordan on 9/11, and he joins us from there today. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
And Daoud Kutab, what did you see on September 11th?
Well, I was meeting with a friend of mine, a CBS, a local CBS reporter, and, you know, all of a sudden he got a call from New York, and, you know, they told him, you know, this Twin Tower was hit. And so he had to leave. I decided to go, and I decided to take it. I heard, please turn the radio on. And he said, no, there's nothing on the radio except music. I said, no, there's something important happening. Please turn the radio on. So he, you know, agreed with me, and all of a sudden, you know, it was very unusual for Arab radio to be following, you know, live events, because it's usually state-run radio, but they were actually giving a blow-by-blow account of what was happening. And then by the time I got home, I think the second tower was hit. It was very sickening feeling. It was a very sickening feeling that you got that, you know, something very bad was happening. And you know, it became, you know, a decade of real horror for the whole Middle East, because I think as Palestinians, we thought we were, you know, getting close to some kind of a breakthrough, and this really shifted the entire Middle East, because, you know, the Russian, you know, the Cold War was over. Now there was a new kind of Cold War, but this time against the Arabs and Muslims, and we were stigmated again with terror, and it's been very difficult to really have any progress on any issue, because this was the kind of front and center issue for the whole region.
Many Americans have an image that Palestinians cheered the attack on the World Trade Center. Is that accurate?
Well, there were a few boys who went out and passed a suite in Damascus Gate in Jerusalem, and somebody filmed that. But for the entire, I would say, Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, I think it was a very genuine, and I think for the whole world, there was a genuine sympathy, and it was a very unusual moment when the whole world actually felt American, felt the support for the Americans. I remember even Yasser Arafat donated blood as a kind of a symbolic sign of supporting those who were hurt. So it was, you know, it's the kind of thing that, you know, was blown out of proportion in a huge way to kind of stigmate the Palestinians. But in general, there was a very genuine, deep sympathy and empathy for what was happening to the people of New York and Washington and Pennsylvania. And I think people really did feel very strongly supporting the innocents who were killed, and feeling genuine, you know, sympathy for them and anger at who was committing this crime against them.
And I think you're right not to minimize the loss of life and the horrible events in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania. Yet over the course of 10 years, much of the impact has been felt in the Middle East.
Yes. I mean, this is the sad part, that, you know, before that and after that, a lot of people have suffered. And a lot of innocent people. I mean, the, you know, war is the one thing to, you know, to have war between soldiers and military people and so on. But the innocent who get caught in the middle, whether it's in Iraq, whether it's in Afghanistan, or for us in the Palestinian territory, there were a lot of innocent people that were killed as a result, or as, you know, using the excuse of the so-called war on terror that really was not genuinely a war on anything except, you know, on different people. The So, yes, the situation before, during, and after has not been very sobering for people who really, you know, genuinely do want to have peace. And I think there is a genuine desire for peace. And there is a feeling that for different reasons, the external involvement in attempts to hegemonize the region for whatever reason, whether it's for the oil of the Gulf countries or whether it was for other so political, geopolitical reasons, but a lot of innocent people get caught in between, and individuals and groups and communities and nations who really want to be free and independent as the Palestinians have their basically aspirations cut off because of a new kind of a balance of forces or new so-called war that has nothing to do with them.
You mentioned earlier that it was quite unusual for radio to be covering an event live. I would expect that's another of the things that has changed over the last 10 years.
It has. In you know, when I was talking to this guy from CBS, it was from a new radio station that I had set up on the Internet because at the time no independent radio was allowed on the Internet. Since then, the Jordanians have decommissioned and deregulated radio, so there's a lot of private radio, including our own radio, Al-Balad or Ammanet, and we've had a lot of other independent radio stations in Jordan. So things have progressed, and in the last 2 years, I would say, especially the last 6 months, the Arab Spring has also brought a lot of freedom of expression. We're certainly not there. There's a lot, long way to go yet, but I would say there's been a lot of progress. Issues that people never talked about, including the powers of the king and the monarchies and all that, are now being discussed and debated on radio with people calling in freely and asking and making very tough statements. So a lot of things have changed. I would say the Arab Spring, I wrote the other day in the Huffington Post that the Arab Spring defeated Bin Laden or killed him before the Americans got to him. So I think in a way we've kind of bypassed that sad, if you will, stage or phase in the region. And there's still remnants, obviously, of radicals and extremists. But I would say the masses of the Arab peoples who are yearning for independence and freedom, whether following the speech of Obama in Cairo or for other reasons, I think have been seeing the light and seeing that they really do want to join the rest of the world in allowing individuals and people to share in the power of running their own country.
Daoud Kutab, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Daoud Kutab, a Palestinian journalist, a former professor of journalism at Princeton University, with us today from Amman, Jordan, where he was 10 years ago. Let's see if we go next to Kaylee. Kaylee with us from Lansing, Michigan.
Hi.
Hi, Kaylee. What do you remember most from 9/11?
I was in third grade in 9/11. I remember sitting in the class, and one of the administrators came in and beckoned my teacher over, and they happened to stand close to me so I could hear what they were saying. And she leaned in really close to my teacher and whispered, "Something is happening. Do not turn on your TV," which is kind of weird. So I didn't really think much of it, but I went home, and my parents were watching the footage, the coverage of the attacks on the computer, and I remember seeing my parents crying. I had never seen my father cry before, and I really didn't understand what was going on. I was 8. And my mother was furious because some of the teachers in the older classrooms had turned on the televisions, and my brother had seen the attacks with no one there to support him, his family. And for me, one of the strongest images is in the days following, all of the flags everywhere on the block at half-mast.
And
yeah, being confused.
Yeah. This has to have been, if you were in third grade then, a teenager now, and the defining event of your life, would you say?
It's been a very, it's affected my life a lot. a lot of my growing up was in the presidency of George Bush, and everyone always talking about the war and him and a lot of the economy. I've never known anything other than the war, the wars in Afghanistan.
Kaylee, thanks.
What?
I was just going to say thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's see if we go next to, this is Keith, and Keith is in Oak Ridge, Tennessee.
Good afternoon, sir.
Go ahead, please.
A couple observations. I was over in the country of Ukraine on that fateful day. That evening, we were ushered to the hotel lobby, but since we did not know the Ukrainian language, and it was on Ukrainian television, we had a fear that entire cities were being bombed or attacked, since we could not understand where it was located. And it was because of that fear. It took about 15 minutes of watching TV before an interpreter came and reassured us it was just New York City and D.C., basically, rather than all cities of America. Because of the different angle shots, the cameras, it just looked like building after building after building was being exploded. But what observation I took was that the Ukrainian people, I remember an interpreter brought me an American flag as a symbol of his unity, his sympathy, his pity for our country. And one of the interpreters said, if they can do this to America, surely Ukrainians are not even safe. A couple days later, I got out of Ukraine, went to London. On that Friday, they held a memorial. I was able to watch a memorial at St. Paul's Cathedral, I think it was. At 11 o'clock, the Prime Minister had designated 2 minutes of silence. As an American walking the streets of London, seeing taxi cab drivers, policemen pull over their cars, step out of their cars, take off their hats, and put their hat on their chest, their hands on their breast, in solemn silence. It was a striking figure, image, that I'm sure I'll retain years to come, because there was, again, London, the citizens of London, showing their solidarity to freedom-loving people. Of course, went to St. Paul's Cathedral. The streets were packed, 2 blocks away. That's as close as I could get. But when they started singing the national anthem over the loudspeakers, the citizens of London around me, in unison, started singing the national anthem of America. And I was amazed. There's no way I could even recite one line of Great Britain's the national anthem. But here, they were in London singing the national anthem.
We sometimes forget that the 9/11 was the worst terrorist attack in British history, too, considering all of their citizens killed in New York until, of course, the even sadder events for them of 7/7 when their subways and buses were attacked there in London. Keith, thanks very much for the phone call. Let's see if we can get one more caller in. Let's go to Bob, and Bob with us from Merritt Island in Florida.
Yes, sir. How are you doing? My name is Bob. I was in Parsippany, New Jersey, staying at the Hilton Hotel. I was a flight crew member working for a corporate company, and we had just brought people in who went to a meeting in Midtown Manhattan. And, of course, the attacks happened, and it just upset everybody in the entire hotel. People ran out into the street, into the parking lot, and they were, you know, everybody was upset. And then news crews started coming in from other cities. We had one news crew there from Philadelphia, and they began setting up their stuff right away. And it was just, you know, everybody thought, what's going to happen next? Is there going to be an attack? Are we going to be shot? What's going to happen, you know?
And it must have been some days before you were able to get out.
Oh, yes. In fact, it was. As a matter of fact, I had to get a ride home from someone that was staying in the hotel. He happened to be a guy that lived in my neighborhood. And he got himself a rental car, and we went and drove back to Chicago. Chicago was my hometown.
And like many people in rental cars, even U-Hauls were rented to drive home as the planes were taken from the air, grounded in the days after 9/11. Bob, thanks very much for the call.
All right, sir. Thank you very much.
And thanks to you all for your calls and emails and for sharing sometimes difficult memories. I'm sorry we weren't able to get to you all. You can follow NPR's coverage from today's September 11th related events on many member stations and at our website, npr.org. There you can read more personal stories as well as analysis, music, and reporting from around the world, all marking 10 years since the terrorist attacks. You've been listening to live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.